Keep Talking exists to have conversations that might help to make a better society and a better culture. I believe that each guest has important information and stories to make public. This is the Keep Talking podcast. To support it, please take a second and subscribe to the show. It helps to make this content possible. I wanted to start this conversation with a quote from your book, The Secret of Our Success, and put a very simple question to you. And the quote is, quote, the wrong way to understand humans is to think that we are just a really smart, though somewhat less hairy chimpanzee. This view is surprisingly common. A lot of the episodes on this podcast are about human nature. And I want to put the question to you, what do we get wrong about that general assessment of human beings?
Yeah. So the key thing you have to understand, and I teach the course on human nature at Harvard, is that humans had something very different happened in human evolution than we see in most of the other species in the world, perhaps all of the other species, is that our capacities for culture, our abilities to learn from each other and transmit information in a way across generations, non-genetically, has driven much of our species' genetic evolution. So you can't really understand our genetic evolution by thinking about ecologies and forests and what the predators are and things like that, which are going to be important to some degree, but that really many aspects of our physiology, anatomy, and psychology were responses, the genetic components were responses to the pressures created by cultural evolution. And I'll give you a simple example that I use in The Secret of Our Success, and that's that probably over a million years ago, we developed the ability to make fire. Now, we don't innately know how to make fire. And if I dropped a bunch of the listeners into the forest and had them try to make fire and cook without any technology, they'd probably fail. So fire is really hard to make. But it looks like if you look at our stomachs and digestion and our teeth, they only make sense as a species that has fire and cooks. So our digestive tract is a product of gene culture coevolution. So in the same way you can't understand our digestive tract without recognizing that we're a cultural species, we can't understand our psychology and many of the kind of interesting behavioral aspects of humans without taking into account that we have social norms, culture produces ethnic groups, all kinds of things like that.
Yeah. I know you go in The Secret of Our Success, a lot of examples of this. And I thought maybe we could just spend a little time on a phenomenon that I think a lot of people are interested in, which is eye color. And I have a quote here written down about that phenomenon, but maybe I'll just put it to you to get your assessment as to why it is that we have different eye color. And I think the point you just made is illuminated by the story, as you detail in the book, about how blue-green eye colors came into existence in the first place.
Right. So first of all, the background is, and we know, we can look at the genetic code of lots of other species, including our closest relative, like chimpanzees, and we can see that what's in their genetic code, and we know they all have brown eyes. So the question is how did humans ever get different colored eyes, like blue eyes and green eyes? Now, most blue eyes and green eyes are confined to, at least, up until 500 years ago, confined to certain regions of Europe. And particularly around the Baltic. And so when I wrote The Secret of Our Success, the evidence was pointing towards this idea that there was something special about that region. And in particular, that's the one region on the globe where you can do high latitude grain agriculture. So as agriculture spreads into Europe, it eventually gets to the hunter-gatherers living around the Baltic. They adopt agriculture. They become low on vitamin D. And then the brown in our eyes is actually melanin. So the genes that take the brown out of our eyes are actually removing the melanin in our eyes. So they get low in vitamin D because they're not relying on our marine resources. So selection begins to lower the melanin in their skin. And as part of the process, actually removes the melanin from their eyes too. So it's a byproduct of this selection pressure that's induced by agriculture to reduce the amount of melanin in our skin in order to get more sunlight and produce even more vitamin D, which the higher latitude you go, the more you need that. Although that interacts with diet, because if you have good sources of vitamin D in your diet, then there's not as much pressure to lighten your skin. Now, I have to caveat this, though, because since I wrote The Secret of Our Success, this is science and new facts come in. So it is now more of a puzzle because we're finding that some of the ancient DNA from Europe in this region, the hunter-gatherers already had blue eyes. So that is not good for the theory that I laid out in Secret. Now, it's not clear what the other alternative explanation is. And what's important is actually that the blue eyes stay and persist despite the inflow of genes from lots of other places. So there's looks like there's got to be some selection on these blue eyes. But the simple story that I told in The Secret of Our Success has been made more complex by new evidence.
Yeah, very good. And I know you have so many anecdotes in The Secret of Our Success, and there are probably too many for us to cover in our hour together today. But I wanted, just for the listeners, just because it's so fun and interesting, to have you list one or more of those anecdotes of the interplay between genes and culture that explain human nature and humans in general that are that favorite, that you think either really matter or just are kind of mind-blowing to you, that you think are probably interesting to other people to learn about as well.
So do you think that it would be more interesting to have a kind of physiology and anatomy example, or are you thinking more like a psychological example?
Let's go with psychological.
Okay. So my favorite one, and the sort of first one I really hit hard in the book, is the nature of status in humans. So like other species, and you can see this from human ethology and body positions and whatnot, we have a kind of status that we share with lots of other species called dominance. And this comes when there's differences among individuals within a group on their ability to use coercion, aggression, and force. So the dominance display in lots of species, our primate cousins are the most obvious, is this sort of big chest, large body, broad display. You see professional wrestlers do this. It's recognized across societies. But humans seem to have this other kind of status. So the case I've made along with others, and now there's a large body of evidence supporting it, is that this arises because individuals share different amounts of information. And so once you have the ability to really culturally learn from others, then you can tap into this variation in the useful information that's scattered across the minds of others. So people begin to preferentially pay attention to and then give deference to those they perceive as particularly competent, skilled, knowledgeable, anybody who you think it would be worth learning from. So you tend to hang around them, look and listen and watch. And this is why there's this strange character to human status, because dominant individuals, you're afraid of them, you want to stay away from them, you don't look at them in the eye, you look away. But prestigious individuals, you know, it's the sycophant. It's you want to be near them, look at, listen them, watch them, because you're trying to acquire information. So it creates this very different pattern of human status that all depends on the details. And of course, particular individuals can have interesting mixes of that. But so then there's a bunch of things about human status, which we see. It's obviously central to how the nature of social media. I mean, on social media, people even have followers, which is the word we used in 2001 to describe the people in a prestige hierarchy. They're trying to learn from the more prestigious individual by tracking what they say and whatnot. So that's a feature that's hard to understand without thinking about gene culture coevolution.
Fascinating. How about physiologically, is there anything that, you know, has really stuck with you that you personally think is either mind-blowing or relevant for people to know about human nature?
Yeah. So, you know, there's often this, it's easy to get this folk dichotomy between, you know, between humans as kind of intelligent and ability to solve problems on their own with big brains, and then, you know, the fast, strong animals with claws and teeth and stuff. But one interesting place where you can push away from that is to recognize that humans, although we're slow compared to other animals in sprints, we're weirdly good at long distance running. So one of the things that anthropologists found when they studied hunter-gatherer societies is that sometimes there's a technique hunter-gatherers use where they just chase antelopes down, for example, and they can just run for 3 hours. You know, that's about how long it takes to run a marathon until the animal collapses in heat exhaustion. And when you look at human physiology, we're covered with these acrine sweat glands, and we can just pour off sweat that allows us to run long distances. And then if you study anatomy of our feet, and even we have these nuchal ligaments in the back of our heads that allow us to turn our trunks independent of our heads, which allows us to run with this twisting motion that we'll use. And so we have all these physiological adaptations that look like they're for running. But then if you're looking at this body like an engineer, you're impressed with its adaptations for long distance running, which is why we can do that. But then you see a flaw. We don't have a water tank. So we have this powerful sweating system that especially pours water out of our heads, right? That's why your head gets wet when you're really sweaty, cooling us off, keeping our brains cool, all this good stuff. But we have no, where do you store the water? So the answer comes when anthropologists studied, well, how do people in small scale society solve this? How do the hunter-gatherers solve it? And it turns out they have cultural techniques. So they can find water that's buried. They can carry water containers. They turn skins into water containers. Hunter-gatherers in lots of places use long bamboo tubes that they carry on their backs, strung across their backs. And when they need the water, they just pop it up. You can cut vines or roots to get water. And so they use all these different things, which require lots of cultural knowledge. In addition to that, humans aren't innate trackers. In order to pull off this persistence hunting, this chasing down the prey, you need to be able to track the prey even when you can't see it. So there's all this knowledge that goes into tracking that we don't innately have. Other animals track, but they use smell and things like that, where we rely on this detailed cultural knowledge and behavior of the species. So this package we have is this set of genetically evolved changes to our nuchal ligaments and the springy arches in our feet and lots of other features of our bodies, and this cultural knowledge about tracking and how to find water that together gave us this persistence hunting. And neither evolves without the other one, right? So it's this cool sort of interdigitated package.
Fascinating. I would love to spend a little bit of time talking about your personal career. And my understanding is that you have spent, you know, a decent chunk of your career living in different cultures. And I'd love to spend a section of this conversation just learning from you about, you know, salient or, again, kind of fascinating experiences you've had as you've traveled the world and spent time with cultures that, you know, people like myself and other Americans, Westerners probably never will, whether hilarious or just interesting. Does anything come to mind, your favorite stories that you've told over Thanksgiving dinner or just to close friends that you think are worth sharing for a general audience?
Yeah, I mean, in some of my earliest work, I was working in the Peruvian Amazon with an indigenous population called the Machigenga. And I just remember being really impressed at how independent young children were. So I'm thinking about kids in middle childhood, like 8, 9, maybe 10 years old, you know, and they're using machetes, they're gathering food, they're foraging, you know, they're snacking on things from the forest. All without adult supervision. And one thing in particular that always sticks with me is the skill that these young kids had. So the Machigenga built these balsa rafts famously. And to get to this one village, we had to go across this pretty fast moving river. And they just kept a balsa raft on both sides. So the very first time I went there, I got on the raft. And the kid just starts pushing the raft. And I kind of saw how he was pushing it. He was angling the nose into the water. And he just gradually pulled us across. It seemed super easy to him. So I think later that same day, I had to go back to the place where I had been to pick up some equipment or something. And so I was coming and there's the balsa raft. Okay, now I've got to perform this myself. And so I tried to do what he did. And I kind of, you know, I skied and surfed and I thought I had pretty good balance and stuff. And as soon as I pushed it out into the river, it immediately went. And next thing you know, I'm doing whitewater rafting on this balsa raft, trying to figure out how I'm not going to get killed. So I drag it over to the side and I must've tried this 5 times. And every time I was, and I actually didn't get across. I just had to go back and get a little kid. but just these kind of cultural skills that you pick up at a young age. And it just gave me the sense that there's all this embodied knowledge that, you know, it's really a cognitive skill, right? I'm stronger than the kid. I was probably faster than the kid, but yet he knew just how to push this raft to get it across the river.
What does that tell you about, you know, probably that culture and cultures in general about that, you know, the knowledge acquisition that a lot of the secret to our success is really focused on? What do you take away from, you know, that experience and similar ones elsewhere?
Yeah. Well, one is that something, a lesson about child rearing is that I think in at least in my world, kids aren't given a lot of responsibilities. They're not allowed in any kinds of situations with danger. But I really saw these kids thriving and really adapting to these tasks and developing skills that, you know, I guess our kids spend a lot of time in school, so they're developing other skills, but that our kids would never get. So that is an interesting question about child rearing and stuff. And I'm often thinking about that. But off the idea that you're building in, you're wiring up your brain for the ability to navigate the world you confront. So, of course, crossing these rivers in balsa rafts was part of the world these kids had to navigate. And so from a young age, they were developing cognitive abilities that allowed them to navigate this world. Now, this feels like a physical skill, but like I said, it's probably really much the cognitive part is the more important part, the technique. And I think that's true for lots of things. So in the same way, we're developing certain cognitive skills for navigating our world. When you grow up in other places, you develop a very different set of cognitive abilities. So I think it's important to keep these in mind when you're trying to understand comparisons across societies.
Yeah. And dovetailing on that idea of different types of cultures and societies in the world, I wonder if you're comfortable sharing, learning about what you've seen in terms of how much variety and difference there is across, you know, your experience with these different cultures in terms of human behavior. You know, you just mentioned the way in which children are given responsibility at a far earlier age than certainly we do here in the U.S. When you've traveled around the world, have you mostly been, you know, blown away by how different cultures are, largely dependent upon their context, or not necessarily? Do you see human nature as fairly stable in the variety of different places that you've visited?
Yeah, I mean, my take on this question is that I feel like I see both. There's a tendency for people to want to emphasize either the cultural malleability and the variation or the human nature side. But I see both. So right now we were talking about some interesting cultural variation, and I can talk about that in other ways. But the example that I led off with is the prestige and dominance example, which is the nature of human status is something everywhere I go, I think I see prestige and dominance, and it all looks pretty similar. I mean, the domains in which one gets prestige in, for example, varies a lot across societies. And at least among hunter-gatherer societies, there's a handful of different domains, which are actually pretty constant. But then, of course, that varies across other societies. There's interesting sex differences, for example, that seem recurrent. I was talking about the Macho Genga. I mean, the complaints that men seem to make about their wives sounded awfully familiar to me, even though we all, the environments couldn't be more different. So lots of things like this. So there's lots of human nature and there's lots of cultural variation.
For comedic purposes, what were some of those complaints that you heard?
So we were discussing having additional wives, because a couple of the Macho Genga had two wives. And one of the guys was saying, and I heard a judge actually in Vancouver, Canada, where I was living when I was working on this, make exactly the same comment. He said he didn't know how you could have two wives because he finds that his wife gives him enough to do and nags him about all the things he hasn't done yet. Awesome.
Yeah. Fascinating. You mentioned earlier in the conversation that you teach the course or a course at Harvard on human nature. And, you know, I assume most of the students that are in those class are weird people. They're, you know, Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic, that they come from that section of the human race. What do you find in your expertise, having studied human nature for so long? What do we fundamentally, as weird people, misunderstand, if anything, about human nature fundamentally that you think is really important for people to understand?
Yeah, I think one of the big things is that there's a bias in weird thinking to focus on one is called analytic thinking. So that means when you approach a problem, you tend to focus on breaking things down into elements and assigning those elements properties. So just to give you an example of how this works, in physics, you break things down to smaller and smaller particles, and then you try to explain how things operate at that level by assigning properties. So you might assign molecules certain properties, or atoms, charges, you know, electrons and protons, that sort of thing. Now, if you're an economist or a psychologist, you assign people preferences, which is what economists do, or personalities, which are these dispositional traits, like a person could be honest, which means they're honest across many different contexts. It doesn't matter who they're interacting with. And what we see in lots of societies is people think about stuff in terms of relationships. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't say someone is honest. You could be very honest with your family, but not very honest with strangers. Does that mean you're honest or not honest? So there's this big difference in this dispositional thinking versus this relational thinking. And I find this operates across a lot of different domains of life. So there's the trustworthiness and whatnot. But there's also something like what leads to success. So a typical weird way of thinking would be that, you know, it could be your persistence, your diligence, your intelligence, all of these things are what leads to success. Whereas in lots of other places, it's, well, what are the relational things that matter? Like one would be obviously, who do you know? So people think that that matters for your success, but also like the experiences and context you're in seem to be given relatively more weight. So psychologists stumbled on the first part years ago. They call it the fundamental attribution error. And that's the tendency to assign things to the properties of an individual as opposed to the context of the situation. But then if you go to other places, you don't actually see that error. So it turns out to be the weird attribution error.
Fascinating. You were talking earlier about dominance and status, and correct me where I'm wrong about this, but your view on how people tend to gain prestige and status is from being a trusted source of information, having good judgment, displaying competence over time. And if in general that I've summarized that about right, is that in your mind the primary method by which all people tend to gain prestige and status? Is that unique to, you know, male hierarchies? And specifically, you were talking about sex differences earlier. How do you think about that phenomenon in people? And I have to think this may dovetail into one of the big points of The Secret of Our Success, which is that we are collective brains, that our intelligence comes from cultural knowledge, that none of us individually would be able to survive on our own, and that identifying people who are sources of truth, wisdom, good judgment is really imperative to our survival, and therefore might be a big reason why those people tend to gain that sort of earned status and reputation.
Yeah. So the idea is that, you know, from a young age, individuals are trying to identify who in their social milieu is worthy of paying attention to. And so they use cues of competence and status and whatnot. So if you become particularly skilled, competent, successful in value domains, then you get accorded some kind of prestige. Now, of course, you could acquire status by getting control of costs and benefits. So you might be rich. That would give you control of costs and benefits. You could be promoted in an organization, so you have institutional power, things like that. Or you might just be big and threaten people with physical violence. So those all can give you a kind of status, but that's dominant status as opposed to prestige. Now, on the prestige side, prestige plays a big role in the collective brain, because part of what makes innovation occur in the collective brain is that we're looking out and we're figuring out who to attend to, and then we take ideas from different people, and we recombine them to produce new baby ideas. So who you're attending to has a big effect on the ideas you get and then the novel recombinations you make.
Fascinating. I've had a bunch of conversations recently about men in our society. And I know from our first conversation, and this may be a good segue to talk about men. We had a conversation during that chat about polygyny and some of the modern phenomenon of dating apps and the plight of men. I think you actually in that first conversation mentioned Richard Reeves's book of Boys and Men, and I later had him on the show as well and talked to him about that book. And you and I were going over some ideas to talk about how men might be given tools to try to improve their station in our culture, to, you know, rise up a competence hierarchy and to try to thrive in modern culture. I think you noted, which Richard did as well, that if you look at educational achievement, for example, men are really falling behind in high school and graduation rates. And I think you brought up, you know, two potential ideas, one being single sex classes and additional time for recess for boys. In the spirit of kind of a theme of the show in the last month or so, I wanted to bring our conversation back to this to some degree and put that question to you. I don't know if you've you know, thought more about this in our own culture and how boys and men might be able to have options to improve their situation to thrive in our culture. I think you have a son, if I remember correctly. I'd love to just open up the conversation to see if you've thought about that in any more detail, and if so, any suggestions or ideas you may have in that domain.
Yeah, I mean, the first idea that I've thought about, and I was pondering how to do it, maybe you have ideas, which is that I feel like there's this question of role models for young men. So, you know, there's all this discourse about toxic masculinity. But a number of people, probably including Richard Reeves, have argued for a kind of pro-social masculinity. So it's okay to be masculine. You just got to get rid of the toxic stuff. And what I think is happening with the rise of incels, and there are similar movements in Asia, the disenfranchisement of lots of low status males is actually fueling more of the kind of stuff you might not want. So trying to give positive role models, I guess, for the way boys can be. I mean, we're naturally cultural learners. So you want to give people, boys, role models, meaning other males who they can learn from and learn how to approach the world in a way that's positive, but feels good to them as well.
Yeah. I heard Richard say in an interview I was watching of his yesterday that, you know, he views the term toxic masculinity as a form of a slur, and that the phrase that he has sort of introduced as an alternative would be immature and mature masculinity, that could be a different way to think about how boys and men might be on a kind of continuum with that. And, you know, I know you teach on a college campus, and do you see this phenomenon yourself? You know, is it noticeable to you even in your classrooms that the ratios are significantly different? I think it was Richard who told me that the sex difference in colleges is greater today than it was in the early 1970s, where in the early 70s, when my parents were in college, it was something like two men to one woman in college, and now that's inverted. Do you notice that at school yourself? Is that something that you've seen personally?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, my department is 70% female. So we're the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology. We're dominated by females. I mean, I'm not involved in Harvard admissions, but I get the sense that they struggle to keep things roughly equal at 50-50. I'm not sure where the males are ending up in terms of majors. I mean, obviously they're biased towards math and things like that, but then that's not going to cover all of them. Certainly many of the top students are often female now. So I think we see the same general thing that Richard has been describing, even at the Harvard level.
Yeah. You study cultures, and I'd be curious to know where you think this is likely heading. I know we talked a couple of years ago about this, and we brought up I think it was you who told me that, you know, the majority of current societies on Earth are polygynist, meaning, as I understand it, that, you know, high status men are open to having multiple wives or multiple female partners, and that we seem to be unintentionally moving in that direction with modern technology and modern dating apps. And absent from what, you know, ethically or just societally we think would be the healthiest option for people in general. And I know you've written extensively about monogamy and the history of monogamy and the effects of that. If you had to just take out your scientist brain and give an assessment of where you think Western culture or America is headed in this specific domain, which is a lot of life, how would you respond to that? Where do you think we're going?
Well, first, let me just first fix up something you said, which is that in the modern world, the majority of countries have laws that prohibit polygynous marriage. There remain some societies in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa that allow polygyny. Although generally it is on the decline in those places. So I think what I said was that traditionally 85% of human societies allowed elite and high status men. Mm. But then what happened monogamy becomes popular, becomes the thing in Europe with the spread of Christianity, and then you get imposed monogamy. And then when the Europeans expand around the world after 1500, other places, including China, Japan, Korea, all these places, start adopting Western laws. And part of the package of things they adopted include laws that prohibit polygyny. So that's meant the story of how the world became, have mostly monogamous laws, is the story of the European expansion. But okay, so then I've made the case that monogamy actually reduces this excess pool of low status and unmarried men, because otherwise all the rich guys would take additional wives, and then you get this big pool of low status married men. And I argue that this is bad for social harmony. These guys have to take risks to try to get into the marriage and mating market. There's all these potential downsides to that, at least at a societal level. But now in the modern world, we see something totally new happening, which is the recreation of this pool of low status and unmarried men, because as women enter the labor market, they don't need husbands. And so they either find some high status male. Women are generally unwilling to marry with men. They want someone of equal or higher status. They don't like to go down. So that bias means that you end up with this pool of low status men. I've seen nothing but that problem getting worse. And in fact, I think it's worse in places like Korea and Japan, maybe China, just because they were more patriarchal when this problem began. Things like dating apps, at least the current ones we have, seem to only make this problem worse. So we may have discussed this in our last conversation, but the dating apps, a small fraction, 5% of the men get 90% of the interest from women. And then there's 50% of the men on there who never get a single, you know, like or invitation or all, you know, whatever they call them on the different apps. So this just recreates the same problem again. And then you can see crime and other female hatred and all kinds of bad stuff kind of percolating within this community. So I think that's bad. And we got to fix the male inequality problem. I mean, one way to fix it is just to fix inequality in general, because if you reduce the total amount of societal inequality, you're going to mitigate this problem.
Fair point. I think, you know, since we talked a couple of years ago, I was able to have Roy Baumeister on the show as well. And I think Richard talked about this. We may have talked about this as well. And if this is your understanding too, and I think to me, this is initially a bit of a hard fact about our human history to understand, but I think Richard has explained it pretty well, and as has Roy, that there's good evidence to believe that in our human story, people have twice as many female ancestors as male ancestors, meaning that, you know, roughly half of men in history did not have children. I may be butchering that in some of those details, but is that roughly your understanding of the human story between?
I mean, the good thing, I mean, the data on that is getting better and better, and it may be even a more extreme situation than your number suggests. I might have said 4-to-1. And we get that by looking at X and Y chromosomes. So you get your Y chromosome from your dad, and X chromosomes are transmitted from mom. And so by comparing those, we can see that there are many fewer X chromosomes in human history than Y chromosomes. So that means there's many fewer fathers than there are mothers. And then we can just look at the ratio of those and make estimates of that. And of course, that varies. So there's a period, you know, 8,000 years ago when things got, it varied across continents, but roughly 8,000 years ago, things get extreme where the number of mothers to fathers is much greater. But then as you go back before about 10,000 years ago, at least last time I looked, it was about 4 mothers for each father. So
fascinating. There are just factoids and learnings from my research from our first conversation that have really stuck with me. And when I was telling people that you were coming back on the show in the last week, a couple of them I reiterated to people, ones that I just thought were so damn interesting. And I wanted to, you know, put them to you. You mentioned earlier that, you know, science evolves and things change based on the evidence. There are two that I'd love to bring up just to get your current thinking on. The first one is related to testosterone levels. And my understanding from our first conversation was that there was good evidence to believe. I think initially you mentioned that people had believed that it was an inevitability of male humans that over the course of your lifetime that your testosterone levels would decline predictably once when men got married and again when they had children. And those tests had been done, that truth had been obtained through tests on weird men. But my understanding is that your conclusion when we last talked was that evidence seems to not be correct, that if you analyze the testosterone levels of men in non-weird countries where men can have multiple partners and are sort of consistently on the dating and mating market into their 50s and beyond, you don't see a correlate, you don't see a similar decline in testosterone levels, and that decline is more a testament to monogamy than it is to a truth about general male biology. I don't know if I summarized that correctly, but I wanted to put that to you and get your thoughts on whether that you still believe that to be true.
Yep. I mean, as far as I know, the current evidence still supports that. And I think the case has gotten even better. And this also fits with the human data definitely shows this, but we can also see the same kind of things operating in other species. The main difference is that in humans, we have some societies that have this, monogamous normative monogamy and others that don't. And we can see the difference between those societies. And part of it was a kind of weird people critique, suggesting that you can't rely on findings done in weird societies, because it turns out that the marriage system affects the hormonal profiles of people, and in this case, men. So a lot of the low T phenomena that we see is and probably an interaction of the marriage and mating thing. So it's well known that divorced men, testosterone goes up. So you have to get divorced, I guess, in order to get that effect, or you're doing something counter-normative. But in polygynous societies, it's perfectly normative to continue to pursue mates even while you're married. So you don't have that decline.
Fascinating. The other one I wanted to go over with you, it was, and I think we talked about this towards the end of our first conversation, the big five personality traits, and that, I've talked about this many times on this show, but the acronym being OCEAN, openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, that too was taken as a, accepted fact of human nature, as I understood it. But that there was evidence, I think, from a study we talked about a couple years ago in Bolivia that seemed to disconfirm that truth. And my understanding is that there were only two of the five that were found in that study of a non-weird culture. I think it was pro-sociality and industriousness. Again, I just want to put that to you to get your current thinking on that phenomena. And obviously, you're welcome to add anything else that you think is relevant.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So it's a group in the Bolivian Amazon. Now, that's a one-off study, super well done, but a one-off study. But other studies of existing cross-cultural data show that even though you can kind of squint and maybe see the five-factor solution, what researchers have done is you have the five factors, and you can in the U.S. the factors are uncorrelated, so the correlation between any two of the five factors is zero. But as you try to replicate that same structure in different societies, and they've got many societies from around the world, you find that it doesn't fit so well. And one measure of the lack of fit is what the intercorrelation is between the different factors. And it turns out you can predict that intercorrelation if you know the kind of occupational or social niche diversity. So urban centers in the United States, it fits perfect, right? Zero correlation. And when you go to the Chimane, which is this Bolivian group with two factors, then it completely collapses and all the factors have folded into each other and created something different. But in between, there are all these societies where there's not so many occupations. It's in a rural urban area, where they get closer and closer together. And it's easy to kind of project that and say, oh, well, at some point, these two collapse into each other, and then these two collapse into each other. So there's a lot of other supporting evidence for that general view that our personality structure is just a way in which we can each adapt to the niches in society. So this doesn't mean there's not a genetic component, because your choice to become a librarian probably has something to do with your inclinations to not have to be too extroverted, a liking for quiet places, all those kinds of things. But then when you get to go every day and be in a quiet library place and only interact in hushed tones with a few other people, you know, it kind of exaggerates your characteristics. Where if you're inclined to be a used car salesman, but then every day you have to go and be, you're going to love this one, you know, try to sell the car, you, that becomes more and more who you are. And, you know, you can see how it exaggerates from there.
And I think you just explained this, but that it's really the details of the culture. And I think you said this as well, the economy, the occupations that are available that seem to bring out this greater variety of personality types, the big five. Is that fair to conclude?
Yeah. And the simplest way, the Chimane are like lots of human societies where there's basically two occupations, husband and wife. And, you know, the husband's in charge of hunting and planting certain kinds of crops, and the wife is in charge of child rearing and planting and certain kinds of gathering and, you know, keeping the fire. And so those are the two things you have to figure out how to do. Whereas, you know, in our world, there's this proliferating number of different occupations that seem to be cut finer and finer as time goes by.
Yeah. I'd love to spend the rest of our time together just having fun and talking about some of the more interesting findings that, you know, you've discovered in your career and in your travels. And I want to obviously welcome you to add anything that has come to mind that we haven't talked about that you just think is just so interesting about what it means to be human. One of the examples I think I've heard you talk about in another podcast interview you did was related to, I think the word is a gerontocracy in Africa. And you were explaining how this gerontocracy explains the local mating and dating culture, and a lot of that culture specifically because of how, as I understand it, men have to pass through this crazy gauntlet of time, and I'm sure initiation, in order to have access to women. And I wonder if you would be open to, if I've even described that in any accuracy, to go into that in a little bit more detail of what you take away from that, that truth about that culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think this relates to our other discussion about the low status men. So in these societies, male life is organized into a series of initiations, essentially. And so when you're at the youngest stage, you are under the thumb of the older men. And one of the main things they have control of you is that they determine whether you get to pass through the ritual that allows you to go to the next stage. And at some point, and this is different depending on the society, but say there's three stages, you might not get to get married until you go through the second stage. And then you can get married and mate and have kids and do all those things. But before you go through that, you're missing a whole bunch of rights and privileges. And your main responsibility might be community defense. So you might be going on raids. You might have to deal with, you know, guard duty, all kinds of things like that. And you're getting these young men to do a public good. They're doing a service. They're all doing it together. They're working as a team. They're learning how to manage disputes among themselves. And if they don't do it right, they're not going to go through as a single unit. They have to all graduate in some sense. So they keep each other in line and things like that. They end up getting the elderly having control of these young men. The elderly, though, then become, the elderly men become highly polygynous. And that's because you can't get married until you go sufficiently through this set of stages. And I guess the young men could think of it as, well, as long as I follow the rules, I'm going to eventually get to be one of those old guys and, you know, maybe have five wives or something like that. But anyway, so it's a really kind of strict way of organizing society. It gets young men to do pro-social things. You know, it manages the social environment. And this actually spreads because it's very effective in intergroup warfare. So societies that had this structure tended to spread and proliferate compared to societies that didn't. So some of them copied it and some of them got pushed out by it.
Fascinating. I think I am right in describing how in The Secret of Our Success, you go into some detail about, and correct me where I'm wrong about this, how hunting strategies imparted by grandmother killer whales onto their grandchildren help us to explain human menopause in women. If that's at all correct, I'd love to give a little space for you to go into any detail about what you think about that.
Yeah. So, an interesting feature of what anthropologists call human life history is this fact that women will stop, they'll no longer be able to have babies at a certain age, so we call it menopause, and then they'll have this long period of life before they die. And the period of life is sufficiently long that it seems like something is afoot. Now, at first, people thought, well, maybe women used to die younger, and so really it wasn't very long. But it turns out that's not right. All the studies suggest that humans have always had this long period of post-reproductive life for women. So why do they have that? And there's a few different theories. So famously, an anthropologist named Kristen Hawkes has argued that it's for grandmothers to invest in their grandchildren. And Kristen's picture of this is schooled, I think, by her research among the Hadza, where grandmothers would dig up roots. And that so they would supply material and calories to the grandchildren, to their daughter's kids, essentially. Or maybe their son's kids. But I've made the case that that's kind of right. But really what grandmothers may supply is information. So old people have their entire lives to accumulate all this information. And research suggests that, you know, you get old, you get weaker, you get slower. These things seem to happen in all different societies. But the one thing that doesn't decline, even when you're losing a little bit of cognition, like your math skills or whatever, you still retain your crystallized intelligence. So the key wisdom and the processes and skills that you acquire as you go through life, you know, is still all in your head when you're old, even if you can't run so fast and dig roots as well. So my idea is that that is potentially a big source for creating this menopause. So how do we test that? Well, we can test that in humans by, for example, looking at crystallized intelligence versus other kinds of working memory or something like that. And you see working memory decline, but not crystallized intelligence. So that's consistent with it. But can we test this in other species? Turns out that killer whales have menopause. So the prediction would be that what are grandmother killer whales doing? And one thing they might be doing is transmitting useful techniques, foraging techniques to the young. To their grandchildren. And so I call it the information grandmother hypothesis.
Unbelievable. I know you know a lot about cultures vastly more than most people. And we're both, I think, Americans. And I wonder for you if you give, you know, a lot or any thought to this phenomenon of cultural relativism. I mean, we even in this conversation have touched on how wildly different people are in different cultures and how human beings are largely responding to their cultures in their behavior and in some ways in your biology. I think that was something that we went over in our first conversation. One example you give is about how readers seem to, and correct me if this is not no longer your thinking on this, but that people who are readers seem to lose some of their natural aptitude for facial recognition. There are trade-offs in your own development and that your own culture can change your biology. Where do you come down on the phenomenon of cultural relativism? I don't know if you walk around our Western, country and civilization and think, boy, we have a long way to go, or you typically think this is for how diverse and complicated living with 330 million different people really is. It's a miracle this is working so well. I'd love to give you a little space to give your views on that.
Cultural relativism is a really interesting thing in my job because I spend a lot of time thinking about other societies. And most of the time, my efforts, well, pretty much all my professional time is going to be devoted to trying to understand why societies are the way they are without being judgmental about it. And one of the important things I like to emphasize, so, you know, one of the things I study is psychological variation. So people vary in how conformist they are. Now, when I call another population conformist, sometimes I get pushback on people saying, you're dissing that society by calling them conformist, because implicitly they're saying, well, we all know it's better not to be conformist. But then when you go to those societies and you ask people, you know, how do you value conformity? Do you teach your children to be conformists? They say they value conformity and that one should teach their children to be conformists. And a developmental psychologist named Christine Laguerre showed videos to parents of children who were either being more conformist, doing exactly what they were shown, or being more innovative. And mothers in Texas thought the innovative kids were the smart ones. And mothers in Vanuatu thought that the conformists were the smart kids. So just quite different on who's being smart. So that's just an interesting difference in cultural values. And part of the story of the weirdest people in the world is that our cognition is adapted to the institutional worlds that we have to navigate. So if you want to survive and be successful in Vanuatu society, probably being more conformist is going to help you navigate that world better. Now, that doesn't mean you can't get mismatch, right? So if you're to migrate to the United States and try to survive, you might be at a mismatch. You might be more conformist than would might be optimal for success and navigating the American world. But yeah, so one of the tricky parts about having a multicultural society is figuring out we do have to agree on a bunch of things. So for example, something like religious tolerance or trust in strangers really allows the society to be more productive and interact in ways that I think everyone would agree are socially beneficial. So whether it's artistic flourishing or technological innovation, I'm writing a book now showing that trust and tolerance with strangers leads to more of all that. People are also happier when they're trusted and tolerated. So basically, it's all good stuff. But of course, we have these instincts, our tribal instincts, which kind of push away from that and make us less tolerant of other religions or other cultural groups and less inclined to entrust strangers. So you're constantly trying to figure out, we want everyone to be trusting of each other, which makes them more similar. But where can we say it's okay for people to be different, right? And so it's trying to negotiate that's the hard part.
Yeah, absolutely. And tolerating disagreement to some degree, right? Because inevitably, if that's the culture you live in, that will occur. Go ahead.
I'm interested. So you sounds like you've thought a lot about this cultural relativism. It's the people who are most ardent about cultural relativism, they seem very intolerant of people of lots of kind of a funny thing.
Yeah. I don't know that we talked about this a couple of years ago, but personally, I think what you study is some of the most interesting work and one of the most interesting subjects on Earth, which is just human nature in general as a catch-all. And I don't know that we covered this at all of what it was about, your life or yourself that motivated you to go into this space. It may have just been pure curiosity, but I'd love to hear that from you as to you've spent decades, I think, focusing on the sort of stuff that we've been talking about today. Why or how has this subject kept your attention as deeply as it has for as long as it has? How do you explain that for yourself personally?
Yeah, the great thing about my job and studying human evolution, human nature and stuff is that it's a vast area. So I never have to worry about getting bored because I might get bored with a paper that I'm currently writing, but then there's another paper to be written where I got to read new stuff and learn new things and things, so it's constantly getting a chance to do new things. So I'm for the first time in my life, I'm going to study chimpanzees in the wild. Never studied chimpanzees in a while. And I'm starting a research project. There might be Prestesian chimps. So we're going to take a look and see whether we find that. So it's testing an old idea of mine, but in a completely new context. So I think that's the main thing that keeps me interested. And I think diving into new areas also keeps you intellectually fresh.
I can totally relate to that. And maybe you just answered this with the question of whether there's prestige in chimps, but what do you see as the frontier in, new acquisition of knowledge that we may be able to obtain about, human nature or our own evolutionary history? When you look to what makes you scratch your chin and get excited about, learning, what are those subjects?
Yeah, there's a few areas that I'm interested in right now. The one I'm kind of focusing on most heavily at the moment is in the domain of what I call historical psychology, where we're trying to use techniques from natural language processing. So working with data scientists and people like that, as well as historians, trying to go look at text. So everything from US newspapers to a corpus of Latin texts, for example, going back 2000 years, trying to extract measures of psychology. And so the simplest first thing we're trying is what psychologists have done to study political speeches. For example, in the United States, they use these word bags. So you get a set of words, one set of words equals tightness, the other set of words is associated with looseness, and you can rank political speeches on how tight or loose they are, or on how what the moral foundations are. Do they tend to be interested in loyalty and hierarchy, or are they more about harm and fairness and justice? So you can do that with contemporary political speeches. But we're trying to do that with a large database of U.S. newspapers that gives us variation across space and time and goes back to 1840 or so. And then the question is are there things about history? What happens when a pandemic, the Spanish flu hits in 1919? You know, what happens during the Civil War? How did counties most shocked by the Civil War, how does it affect their psychology as captured in the newspapers? So it's kind of a new way to get psychological change over time. The other data source that is interesting, and it's outside of my expertise, but the laboratory next to my lab is David Reich's lab, and his expertise is ancient DNA. So he's doing all kinds of fascinating stuff with ancient DNA. But what I want to do is figure out how we can use ancient DNA to read cultural practices. And just to give you one example, because of gene culture coevolution, we may be able to find out when cultural practices appeared that otherwise would be invisible to us by looking at which genes change frequency. So my go-to example is there's a particular gene which has been argued to be a change in human genome in response to the toxins in smoke. So once humans had fire, we started sitting around the campfire, we started inhaling campfire fumes constantly, and this favored genetic changes, which means we have resistance to the toxins in smoke to a degree that other species don't. But if we can see those in the genome, then we can infer the existence of campfires. And now so we can look in all the different genomes and try to figure out when the campfires appeared. So I wonder how many other things there are like that. We've also got, you know, we can confer cousin marriage from the genome, maybe. So that'll tell us when people are changing their kinship practices.
Yeah. This will be one of my last questions, because I know we're getting close to the end of the conversation. And maybe I should have started with this question, even in our first chat earlier, a couple of years ago. But, you know, this podcast in part is just a selfish project for me to learn from brilliant people like yourself, but it's also interested in human nature and finding out what's true to the best of our knowledge about what it means to be human. And you alluded to this earlier that, you know, data and science are ever evolving based on new evidence that comes our way. But if you had to give a high level description of our best understanding, you know, in a relatively brief description of the story of what it means to be human based on what you think is, you know, incontrovertible evidence that's very well backed by data, to somebody that isn't familiar with, you know, your classes or the literature, how would you give that description as to, you know, what that means, who we are and where we come from?
Well, I think one of the things that I would be inclined to emphasize that I think is underappreciated is a concept that you mentioned earlier, is our reliance on the collective brain. Hmm. So we tend to think of, and this is the book I'm working on, we tend to think of inventions and all the fancy things that humans have figured out that other animals haven't figured out as the products of our individual big brains trying to solve problems. But I think you can make a good case now that so much of what drives innovation are larger and more interconnected sets of minds. And it's really the flow of information among minds, the recombination of ideas that generates fast. And you can show this in experiments. I mean, if you can compare US cities, larger cities are disproportionately more innovative. And you can use patents or measures of artistic flourishing, all kinds of different things. A simple example of the power of the collective brain would be when Prohibition, of course, most people know about the Prohibition era in the United States, starting at the end of 1919. But it turns out that different U.S. counties started Prohibition earlier than that, a decade prior. And so when Prohibition hits in a state, what you see is that the counties that had a lot of saloons start being less creative. So their patenting goes down. You might say, that's puzzling because people have stopped drinking this brain damaging chemical. They've also stopped getting together in saloons and swapping ideas. And it turns out that swapping ideas trumps the brain damage from the dangerous chemical. And that's really what drives innovation. So you see this decline due to Prohibition. So it's cool insights like that that I think show the degree to which we're a collective brain species.
Yeah. Thank you, alcohol. Let's close on this. I know you just mentioned this, that you have a new book that you're working on, and, you know, if we can find the time and you're open to it, I'd obviously love to have you back on to talk about that book whenever it's ready. But give us a sneak peek. I know you gave some details there, but anything else you'd love to close on about, you know, what you're working on? I think listeners would love to hear too.
Yeah. So part of the idea is the role of the collective brain, And I think that one fun fact to like maybe leave with on the kind of human evolutionary story is a lot of people have remarked on the rapid increase in innovation in the last 10,000 years. And that makes sense from a collective brain point of view because societies were getting larger and denser because of the origins of agriculture. And this meant you could have more innovation and exchange ideas. And you see this big takeoff, math, science, philosophies invented and all this stuff. But what's less well appreciated is during the last 50,000 years, the size of our physical brains has been shrinking. It might have declined by as much as 10%. So you have these crossing lines, which is the plot and the prelude of the book, showing that all this innovation is going one way and brain size is going down the other way. And that's because we're becoming more reliant on other people's brains. If you have specialization in technology, you don't have to know everything. You can store it, all this information in different minds. So just the emphasis on the collective brain.
Yeah, fascinating. Thank you again, man, so much. It was great to see you. And I love these conversations. I love your work. And I want to thank you on behalf of a lot of people who will never meet you for your efforts and your output. Thank you again so much. And all right. Best of luck with all the additional work.
Okay, great. See ya.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Keep Talking. If you're finding value in this podcast, please consider supporting the show via the links below on Venmo, PayPal, or Patreon. Your support helps to make these conversations possible.